Well, we have something a bit different for you for our writers' conversation tonight. Tuesday marks the death of an author who was responsible for perhaps one of the best known opening lines of a book. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. Those words from Pride and Prejudice illustrate perfectly what the world of Jane Austen was about. Her books, including Emma and Sense and Sensibility, are set in the England of the late 1700s and are all about the intricate dance surrounding marriage, at a time when marriage was seen as a woman's only real shot at success in life. So what is it about Jane Austen's work 200 years down the track that still inspires such devotion amongst her followers and a veritable industry of TV and film versions of her books? Susanna Fullerton is the president of the Jane Austen Society of Australia, and she's published a memoir called Jane and I, A Tale of Austen Addiction. And Margot Riley is curator of the State Library of New South Wales, where she's an expert in the Regency period, the period in which Jane Austen's novels are set. Welcome to both of you to Nightlife.
Hello.
Hello.
Now, Susanna, is it possible to say what it is that continues to inspire so many devotees such as yourself 200 years after Jane Austen left this mortal coil?
Well, really, it's the quality of her writing. I think she was the greatest novelist who has ever lived. So next Tuesday is a very, very important day in the literary world. It will be a sad day because Jane Austen died at the age of 41, leaving only 6 completed novels behind and various other fragments. But it will also be a day of celebration because she so enormously enriched the world of English literature.
She was so young and yet such a wise old head on her shoulders.
Yes, and her understanding of human nature. We love her novels because of the humour, the romance, the irony, her brilliant use of the English language. Mm. Every word works for a purpose.
Well, they're not all just about marriage, are they? They're about society.
They're so much deeper.
Yeah, and
she uses that to get into human nature.
It.
And she understood people and what makes people tick, and that hasn't changed in 200 years. So her books are still just as relevant today.
You think you can still?
Absolutely. Yeah. People mightn't be riding in carriages or wearing Regency gowns, but the central concerns in her novels are still part of our world today. We all have maybe difficult parents to cope with. We have friends who prove to be false. We have to try and find our career paths in the world. And I think most of us want to meet somebody that we can fall in love with and live happily with. Those are the things that Jane Austen's writing about, and they're just as relevant today.
All right, well, let's go back for you. Your memoir's about your addiction to her books. What was your first encounter with Jane Austen? For most of us at school.
Well, it wasn't for me. It was on a family holiday, and my mother used to read to me all through my teens. And I was about 12 or 13, and she said, "I think you might be ready for Pride and Prejudice." So she propped herself up on her bed and did some knitting as she read to me. And I lay along the end of the double bed, and she began with that sentence that you read before. And I was entranced from the very beginning. And really, as a result of that reading of Pride and Prejudice, my entire life changed. And that's what my memoir is about. Jane Austen has given me my career as a lecturer and as an author and as a literary tour leader. She's given me most of my friends and most of my social life. So reading Jane Austen has completely and utterly changed my life.
Wow.
So that's what I talk about in my memoir.
I wish she had no inkling that this would happen, did she? That, you know,
None at all.
So many years on, people like you would be so influenced. Margot, what was your first encounter with Jane Austen?
Well, mine was a bit of a double bunger because I'm a film lover, and even as a young child, the old black and white midday movies, whenever you were not at school, if you were sick, even or you managed to get a day off.
and one of
my favourites was Greg Arson and in Pride and Prejudice. And I just adored that film. I knew even at the very young age, at the age of 10, because I'm a dress historian, that's one of my passions in life, and I knew the frocks were wrong. I knew that they weren't reflecting the Regency period correctly, but I still loved it. It was so mad. And Laurence Olivier as well.
Those dresses Darcy. Had escaped from Gone with the Wind, hadn't they?
Is that right?
It was they just were totally madcap. And then in terms of the literature, it came a little bit later when I was visiting grandparents, and it was in far north Queens, New South Wales, at Murwillumbah. And so in the subtropical heat in the afternoon, we would go to the veranda, and there was an enclosed veranda, and we would be given a tome to read, either Dickens or Bronte, or in my case, it was Austen. And yes, Pride and Prejudice was my choice.
About the cold Austen while yes. you're sitting on the hot,
hot,
muggy veranda in Murwillumbah. Okay. All right. So you said that you see great parallels with human nature, Susanna, in and now, and it still all applies. What about in terms of dating and finding love? Do you? It's so you can't think how much it's drastically changed, but does it still resonate?
Absolutely. I think people still want to fall in love and meet the right person, whatever sex, and find happiness with another person. And so that's what Jane Austen is writing about. She's writing about finding somebody who will be an equal partner to you in your life.
And you find the Tinder generation are still
absolutely,
relating.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's so many young readers loving Jane Austen. And, this crosses cultures. Jane Austen is being celebrated around the world this coming week. There are Jane Austen societies in Brazil, Argentina, the Netherlands, Italy, Pakistan, Singapore, Japan, the Czech Republic, Germany, of course, England, Scotland, Ireland,
of
Wales,
course, yeah.
Canada, America, and the list goes on. Mm-hmm. So even in translation, where you're losing quite a lot of the irony and the subtlety of her language, her books are much loved. New film versions keep bringing younger readers to the books. Things like Lost in Austen or Bride and Prejudice, the Bollywood version.
That's fantastic.
So younger people are coming to these novels and discovering that they're still very applicable to their own lives.
Yeah, we talked a bit about Bride and Prejudice when we did this, when we talked about Jane Austen in Chick Flicks a few weeks ago on the Saturday Night Show. And yes, it's the Bollywood version. And I can see a lot of parallels with dating in India with,
absolutely.
With Jane Austen.
Too, with Austen. It's about missteps. There are so many instances where people are taken in by appearances or influenced by other factors, and then slowly but surely, you know, the right person becomes apparent for the person. And I think in a contemporary age of dating, many people are taken in by, you know, false advertising through Tinder or whatever the sites are. So I think in many ways it's probably quite, people feel, you know, it happened back then, it happens now. Mm. It's part of, you know, it's part of the world that you have to get to know the person, get to know what's really, really there.
Yeah. I think also what Jane Austen really shows is that you've got to get to know yourself as well.
Yes.
There's a wonderful moment halfway through Pride and Prejudice when Elizabeth has read Mr. Darcy's letter explaining his own behaviour. And she puts the letter down and she says, "Until this moment, I never knew myself." And the rest of the book is really Elizabeth getting to know herself better as well as getting to know Mr. Darcy better.
Before she can love.
And the same happens with Emma. Emma's got to come and understand herself before she can understand how she feels about Mr.
Knightley. That's exactly right.
And so Jane Austen's finer characters learn about themselves. The comic ones like Mr. Collins or Miss Bates
have no self-awareness at all.
And that's why never going to change. And that's why they're so funny. And we don't want them to change as readers. But the finer characters, the intelligent ones in her novels, learn about themselves and other people.
And do you judge people by what's their favourite Jane Austen? You know, like, oh, you're a Sense and Sensibility person. Oh,
it tells you quite a lot about another
like,
person.
Who's your favourite Beatle?
It's fun to argue. If somebody tells me Emma is their favourite novel, they immediately go up in my estimation because it's mine.
Ah.
I think it's the greatest novel the world has ever known. But it's always interesting to discuss and argue and talk about why you love a particular book. And I think your own loves change as you yourself experience things.
Of course.
For many people, Pride and Prejudice is the first love, but many move on to something else. It might be Persuasion or it might be Emma.
I like Persuasion. I'm a Persuasion girl.
A lot of Persuasion is usually second in the favourite stakes after Pride and Prejudice. So it's always really interesting. And that's part of being a member of the Jane Austen Society of Australia, that you can have all those wonderful discussions and we're the largest literary society in this country by a very long way. So we have a wonderful time having meetings, conferences, talks, learning more about the era in which Jane Austen lived, and talking about our favourite writer.
I want to talk about the era. My guests on Nightlife tonight are Susanna Fullerton, President of the Jane Austen Society of Australia and author of the memoir Jane and I, A Tale of Austen Addiction, and Margot Riley, who's a curator at the State Library of New South Wales. Now, Margot, you are an expert in this era. Tell us about the Regency period. What time are we talking about?
Well, it's the Georgian period, so late 18th century and into the early first couple of decades of the 19th century. I think for Australians what resonates particularly is it is the time of colonisation and settlement of Australia as well. So what we read about and see depicted in either the novels or in the film adaptations of Austen, in many instances there are very strong parallels to the situation and the world as it was when Australia was being settled by Europeans. So I think that's a really interesting aspect of viewing Austen. It was a period of following on from the French Revolution, of course. So there was a stripping away of the extravagance of the 18th century and focusing on the classicism, the revival of the classics. So you get in fashion, for instance, they're very straight up and down empire line, as we know. The muslin dresses. The muslin fabric was imported from India, and also lightweight silks. And that was very important again for Australia because we were a temperate climate. So, and we were closer to India and to China than England was. So in many cases, the free settlers in Sydney had access to all of the latest materials. And because the garments were handmade and quite simple to construct, Australian women of the early period could keep up with fashions quite easily with the English fashions.
And looked relatively comfortable.
Yes,
compared
I think
to what
so.
Came
certainly
before.
In the Australian conditions, heat, I think it worked really well. Mm-hmm. So in terms of women's fashion, it was a very simple, straight up and down, that sort of columnar, white was a very popular colour, and, you know, very simple, often very short hair or curls. And for gentlemen, the English fashion was actually, the country fashion was the most stylish way of dressing. There was a gentleman called Beau Brummel who was a, promoted English tailoring, the very fine lines of, you know, very well tailored jackets, very white starched linen, big frothy cravats, beautifully fitted leather boots, and that idea of being standing very tall and being very snappily dressed.
Tell us about the Prince Regent, young George.
Yes, so, you know, in the 18th century, you have the earlier Georges, and then at a point, George III was considered to go mad. He had a disease, he was ill, and so a regent, his son, was appointed, which was the Prince Regent George. Now, he was quite a lavish entertainer. He built the palace at Brighton, that beautiful fantasy palace, and he loved the good life. So he was very influenced by people like Beau Brummel, and he tried to cut that very fashionable figure. So he was very much, and he was also a fan of Austen.
He was indeed. He had a complete set of her novels and all of his palaces.
Yes.
And he was one of the royals who did the most to promote the arts.
That's right.
Is that right? But she didn't really like him much.
She did not like him. And she
Why not?
She disapproved of his morals.
Yes.
He did have strings of mistresses and he overspent and he became very obese and he just gave in too much, I think, to the good life.
Yes.
And she rather disapproved. But she was actually asked to dedicate her novel Emma to him. And it's a bit hard to say no to your future sovereign. And so in a very over-the-top dedication, she does dedicate Emma to His Royal Highness the Prince Regent. But she ladles in so many Your Royal Highnesses that one feels it was done rather tongue-in-cheek. And she thought, right, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to lay it on with a trowel. And
cheeky.
She rather hoped, of course, that it would increase sales of her novel. She was
and
keen
did it?
To
was
have
that
money.
The most
well,
popular?
It certainly would have helped.
Mm.
Of course, she died not that long after Emma came out. So she never made a lot of money from her novels
in her lifetime,
about £630 in
who
her
makes
lifetime.
The money now?
Nobody, which is why she's so popular with filmmakers. She's out of copyright. Anybody can pick up an Austen novel. They can add zombies to it. They can do whatever they like with it. Cartoon it, you know, sequel it, prequel it.
It's out of copyright.
It's all out of copyright, mm-hmm. and no Austen descendants of any of her brothers make any money whatsoever from the whole Austen industry.
Right.
But of course, some of them have also, you know, written books and done various things of their
own.
Her
nephew was the one that actually wrote the biography, wasn't he, in the 19th century, which is actually considered to have really promoted Austen. Her work was sort of in a bit of a hiatus, and then people found out more about her, and that was considered to have actually, you know, encouraged interest in her work.
Yes. And what about in terms of the intricacies of trying to find a mate at that time, Margot? How precisely does she capture it?
Oh, I think she does. The whole business of, you know, how you conducted yourself in society, the, you know, even the introduction to, you know, there's a new young man in the town, well, they can't have anything to do with Mr. Bingley until introductions have been made. It was important their father had to, you know, there had to be that formal introduction made before the girls could even have any chance of meeting, you know, the most eligible man in town. And then, of course, you have the presence of the military in, there were obviously armies, groups stationed all over. Mm. And I think the girls, obviously the, you know, bright young officers were invited to events, but you really had to be quite careful as to who you spoke to in a ballroom. You should not have been. You shouldn't go anywhere unaccompanied. All girls were always, you know, chaperoned. You always had someone with you. I think we see in the Pride and Prejudice books that, you know, it's shocking when Elizabeth walks over to Netherfield on her own, and they say you walked and you came unaccompanied.
Oh, because her sister was
sick. It's so shocking, that she did this. So, you know, there's all of those kinds of rules about how young ladies conducted themselves and were seen, and how that, you know, you couldn't do anything that would potentially damage your reputation and prevent you from being able to be eligible on the market. And then, of course, being in a ballroom situation, there was certain behaviours that had to be maintained there. And we see that again in Pride and Prejudice, where Mr. Darcy, it's his duty to actually dance with, you know, eligible and available young women that he has been introduced to. And he's doesn't actually want to do that.
Dancing was a huge part of
very
of
important
elements of their life, wasn't
and
it?
A way for young people to actually converse and to you know, touch and connect with each other that they would never have been able to. You know, if you weren't married to someone, you shouldn't be, and they weren't your relation, they weren't your brother, you really shouldn't be touching a young man. Whereas in the dance, you had
lots
to.
Of conversations on the
there
dance
lots floor. Of opportunities to whisper things to each other, and there were lots of dances which actually involved kissing. You know, as part of the movement in the dance, there was the pressing of the lips or to the cheek. So
that was raunchier than we thought then, wasn't it?
And a dance took quite a long time. If you stood up with a man for a dance, it could last as long as 30 minutes.
Yes.
So if you had Mr. Collins treading on your toes and getting all the steps wrong, it was a long 30 minutes. Mm. But if it was Mr. Bingley or Mr. Darcy, it was very
never
different.
Never long enough.
Not long enough. But you couldn't say no to Mr. Collins and then hope to dance with somebody else. If you said no to a man, you had to sit out the rest of the evening. So it was no to Mr. Collins, it was no to every other man for the whole course
and
of the
Susanna,
evening.
And Susanna, that's what Jane Austen did so well. Her heroines really work within the limitations of the era, but they still have their own power within that, don't they?
There's a wonderful moment in Pride and Prejudice when Elizabeth says to Mr. Darcy, "You are a gentleman, I am a gentleman's daughter." She knows her place, and she knows that intellectually she's Darcy's equal. And she may not have a fortune, but she's determined to stick up for herself. Jane Austen has given us feisty, intelligent women in her novels who have to obviously cope with the restrictions of life in the Regency, but they still manage to make sure that they keep their self-respect and that eventually, of course, they do find happiness. Even a very young heroine like Catherine Morland in Northanger Abbey, you know, she's 17, she's making her first entrance into the big world, and it's all so exciting. But she's still principled and she's still able to judge people. It takes her a little while to sort out false friends from true, but she's got an innate sense of what is right, and that comes through very strongly in that novel.
And was that Jane Austen as well? She was aware of the limitations and the constraints of her society, but she she wasn't a complete rebel.
She was not a total rebel. I think she was a feminist, but in a quiet
way.
We think she read Mary Wollstonecraft, and she clearly was not a feminist like Wollstonecraft was. She wasn't going to stand up on a soapbox and preach feminism, but it comes through very strongly in her novels that she feels women have their right, you know, should have their rightful place in the world and be treated with respect and as individuals.
On Nightlife, we are celebrating the fact that next Tuesday marks the death of Jane Austen, who, of course, is, well, the most famous author in the world, Susanna Fullerton says. She's the president of the Jane Austen Society. Margot Riley is with me, curator of the State Library of New South Wales as well. Was she poking fun at this era within those
I think there are aspects of it that she laughs at. And, of course, she's an ironic writer, so there's irony in every page of her novels. So sometimes you've got to work out how serious things are. Sometimes she puts particular words into the mouths of characters. But she does give a truly extraordinary portrayal of the era in which she lived, the social life. I've written a book called Jane Austen and Crime, looking at things like elopements to Gretna Green, duelling, gambling, theft, poaching, and even murder in her writing. And even something that is not an obvious feature of her fiction, she's picking up on all those aspects, that things that got people sent out to Australia in that time, and showing her awareness of them and sometimes commenting on them. For example, she gives commentary on duelling. And so I think, you know, she was a writer who was intensely aware of what was happening around her and really reflects it in her fiction. There's been this mistaken belief that Jane Austen only described girls getting married and that she didn't write about what was happening in her world. Her country was at war with France. The French Revolution was happening across the Channel. There were dramatic events in the era in which she lived. But she does reflect them, and in many subtle ways they are there in her novels. Mm. People have written books on Jane Austen and politics, Jane Austen and the French Revolution, you know, her awareness of what was going on. And she even reflects the madness of the king and the regency in her novel Mansfield Park, when the father of the family, Sir Thomas, goes away on a trip to the West Indies, and he puts his eldest son in place, in charge of everything at Mansfield Park, as his regent. And, of course, the son fails abysmally in the job, and it's really in many ways her own commentary on what was happening
on the era at the time
in the country.
Yeah. And, Margot, so what you mentioned Australia before and colonisation had happened at the time of this period. Did we see the dances, the courtship, the social subtleties of that era play out in the more rough and readier frontier lives?
I think you have to realise that, you know, the people that were coming as free immigrants were all coming from this landed, you know, lower gentry in England. That was the level of society that many of them were coming from. So they were definitely raised in the same world that Austen had. And the dream was to recreate England in Australia.
Yeah.
And even, you know, Lachlan Macquarie, the governor, you know, that was he didn't want Australia, Sydney, to be a penal colony. He wanted to turn it into a proper society. So he very quickly, on arrival, set up a calendar of horse racing so that you had the, you know, ladies could wear their latest dresses and they would have a ball. So that was one of the first things that Lachlan Macquarie did on arrival, was to actually try and set up a social calendar so that people would be able to interact and have, you know, come to Government House and be presented and go through all of those rituals that were being experienced back in England. And I think the subtlety that Susanna's been talking about is really part of the ongoing resonance of Austen's work. And the feistiness of her characters. I think one of the best colonial examples is Mary Putland, who was the daughter of Governor Bligh. Now, Governor Bligh's wife didn't come to Australia with him. She stayed back in England. But he came with his daughter, Mary Putland. And she was a very feisty character. I think she was, you know, a real, you know, if Austen didn't model on her, I don't know. So she came out to Australia. Her husband was ill and ailing. He died quite soon after they arrived. And during the Rum Rebellion, she was actually at the gate. She was newly widowed. And she was, you know, had her parasol up, keeping the New South Wales Corps at bay.
With a parasol.
You know, with a parasol, saying, get good back, on her. You know, you are not going to step onto Government House. She was also a fashion plate. She kept up with fashion. She corresponded with her, you know, her mother back in England. Her mother would send the latest fashions to her out in Australia. She was the first person, supposedly, first woman to wear drawers, because in the era with those very narrow muslin dresses, women didn't actually wear underpants as we know them. They would just wear petticoats. But slowly but surely, there was the need to have extra leg covering so that you couldn't see the limbs through the sheer muslin.
Ah.
So we begin this fashion, coming from France originally, of drawers. And it's actually recorded that Mary Putland is the first to bring this new fashion to Australia. She wears her drawers under her lovely dress to church and everybody breaks out laughing. So she's immediate. And this was all feeding into the Rum Rebellion and the sort of, the problems that were happening in the colony, this lack of respect for the, you know, First Lady of the land, and laughing at her openly when she's wearing her latest fashion.
Oh, my
fashion.
Gosh, we might need so to talk about it. You could do a whole
Austin
book on
plot.
Her.
That's why I think Austin is fabulous, because if we look at our own history, we can actually sort of hear, I think it's almost like the lilt and the tone of reading Austin is actually what's playing out.
And it's also about how women are so written out of history.
Exactly.
And here they are in Jane Austen's
so it fills
novels,
the gaps in
front and centre. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How much did Jane Austen's books reflect her own life? She didn't marry, but there were, you know, the rumours of the broken hearts and the nearly elopement. And the like to,
well,
is that
the,
just
the
all rubbish?
Nearly elopement is purely imaginary. That was for the films. We know she received one proposal of marriage when she was 27 from the brother of some good friends of hers. He was a rather awkward young man. She was clearly astonished when he proposed, but she was on the shelf as far as marriage was concerned by the age of 27, and she accepted him. She went to bed and almost certainly had little sleep that night, because when she got up in the morning, she told him she just couldn't marry him. Now, she'd have had a comfortable home. She would have become probably a mother. She could well have died in childbirth. She had two sisters-in-law who died after giving birth to their 11th babies. So I think in many ways we're quite lucky she didn't marry, because we might not have had the novels.
But she didn't marry because she wanted love?
Well, she clearly was not in love with this man, Harris Bigwether, some of whose descendants live in Australia today. Oh. He married another more accommodating young lady, and she wasn't in love with him. And I think the woman who could create Captain Wentworth and Mr. Knightley and Mr. Darcy couldn't cope with the idea of marrying a man she just didn't love. There could well have been another man she met at the seaside to whom she was attracted. It seemed he was going to come back and see her again soon, and he died suddenly. We don't even know his name. And there was Tom Lefroy, the man that her very first surviving letter is about. Handsome young Irishman. She danced with him. She clearly enjoyed flirting with him. But he had five unmarried sisters back in Ireland. He had a career to make in the law. He was dependent on a wealthy benefactor. And he could not afford to marry a girl with no dowry from Hampshire. And Jane Austen's father had no money to give her a dowry.
Right. Well, this is why she became such a great writer. Yeah. All that heartache, perhaps. So in terms of this Jane Austen society, you got some blokes in there that are equally devoted to her work?
We would like some more, but the men who come are huge fans of Jane Austen's novels. And there is a mistaken idea that she's a writer for women. Great writing is for anybody who enjoys good literature, whether male or female. And it shouldn't matter that the writer is a male or the writer is a female. Her novels are for everybody. And some of her greatest fans, like Robert Louis Stevenson, A.A. Milne, Winston Churchill, Sebastian Coe, the Olympic athlete, you know, they're all people who adore Jane Austen, Colm Toybean, the Irish novelist. They've discovered just how wonderful she is. But we would like more men to come along.
And if people want to start, which Jane Austen book should they start with if they haven't read any?
I think it needs to be Pride and Prejudice for a first read.
Would you agree, Margot?
Yes, I would.
Start with Pride and Prejudice.
That'll get you. That'll hook you.
And then you're done.
And then you'll become
you
an addict.
More.
There's
more.
No known cure for this addiction of Jane Austen. And I really hope that on Tuesday, exactly 200 years after Jane Austen died, people around this country will open a Jane Austen novel and read some of it, just in commemoration of the person I think is the world's finest novelist.
Right. And if people are interested in some of the events that the library has on next week, which is our Austin 200 Festival, they can go to the State Library website. We're having, in particular, a trivia night on the 21st of July and also a fashionable high tea on Saturday the 22nd.
That's the New South Wales
yes,
State
New South
Library.
Wales State Library.
All right,
and
fantastic.
There are events taking place around the country.
Yes. Okay, so check out the website for the Jane Austen Society. For Australia and the New South Wales State Library website and your local State Library, and you never know what you could get up to. Thanks so much for talking to us tonight.
Thank you, Sarah.
Susanna Fullerton, President of the Jane Austen Society of Australia. Her memoir is Jane and I, A Tale of Austen Addiction, and Margot Riley, Curator at the State Library of New South Wales, have been my guests.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife. Yeah.